Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
A special thank you to BQE, the makers of BQE Core, for their support this episode. BQE Core is the software that makes it easy to manage your projects and people for maximum productivity and ultimate profitability. Learn more at bqe.com.
I think what's interesting is if you talk to people from various architectural backgrounds and different regions, you'll see that people value the architecture that belonged to their ancestors.
Welcome to Tangible Remnants. I'm Nikita Reed, and this is my show where I explore the interconnectedness of architecture, preservation, sustainability, race, and gender. I'm excited that you're here. So let's get into it. Welcome back. This episode is another fun one, and I really enjoyed getting to know fellow UVA alum Dr. Kendall Nicholson better through our conversation. We cover race and architecture, storytelling and empathy. We touch on how to tap into your network to travel to another country, lessons he's learned so far being a father, and how adopting kids through the foster care system has helped him flex his empathy muscles. This is an expansive conversation where we really get into how everything is connected and how his experiences in one aspect of his life have informed all others. And so let me keep building a little excitement for you and get into his bio. Dr. Kendall Nicholson is a licensed educator, trained architectural designer, and an avid researcher. He works as the Director of Research and Information at the Association of Collegiate Schools of Architecture, ACSA, and is currently furthering his research at Harvard's Graduate School of Design, with work focused on the confluence of race, architecture, and education. He has presented research internationally, and his research interests surround equity, education, and curriculum within the discipline of architecture. Nationally, his passion for equity and racial justice manifests in his role as the research consultant for the 2016 and 2018 Equity in Architecture Survey, sponsored by the AIA San Francisco and Equity by Design, EQXD. He also volunteers as a member of the AIA's Equity in the Future of Architecture Board, and he's on the newly formed NOMA Research Committee. So, as you can see, he is doing the work, and knowing that he is working on architecture education curriculum gives me so much hope for the future of this profession. So the building spotlight this week is the Philadelphia Museum of Art, which was designed by Julian Abel while he worked in Horace Trombauer's office in Philadelphia. And Abel was the first African-American student to graduate from the University of Pennsylvania's School of Design in 1902. I first learned about him when I was a student at Penn, and I was fascinated to learn about his legacy. In addition to being credited as one of the designers of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Abel's body of work also includes numerous mansions in New York, including notably the Manhattan home of the American Tobacco Company founder, James Buchanan Duke. At the time, that home was considered to be the costliest home on Fifth Avenue, which is now New York University's Institute of Fine Arts. And so it was that commission that led Abel to being able to create a legacy at the campus of Duke University. From the university's iconic Duke Chapel to Cameron Indoor Stadium, where the Duke Blue Devil basketball team plays, Abel designed the bulk of Duke's West Campus between 1924 and 1950. And what's wild to me is that because of Jim Crow laws and just general racism, Abel was not welcomed to walk any of the buildings he designed on Duke's campus. So head over to the Tangible Remnants Instagram page to see photos of this week's building spotlight, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and check out the show notes for this episode to see more about Julian Abel's legacy. And also, one more thing before we get into the conversation. If you're enjoying the show, I would love for you to leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you're not enjoying the show, don't worry about it. All right, well, I am excited for you to experience this episode. So without further ado, please enjoy this conversation between me and Dr. Kendall Nicholson. I would love for us to just start with your architecture journey and what got you to architecture.
Yeah, that's a great question. So like many, I decided I wanted to be an architect back in seventh grade. And, you know, it's really interesting. I specifically remember being in seventh grade and I guess having a conversation about careers. And in the classes that I was in, the idea was that like everybody needed something different. And so we had already decided that I was the school future architect, right? And I grew up in a military town. So in seventh grade, another young, Black, intelligent young man came to our school. And he was like, I want to be an architect. And I was like, oh, there can only be one. And it's going to be me because I've been here longer. Which is really interesting because a lot of what we think about the world as children informs our older selves, you know, sure. And you don't actually put it together. Now I'm obviously much wiser, much smarter, and know like there's space for all of us, right? And I actually want there to be more of us. Right. But anyway, so I decided that a long time ago, and it really actually came through seeing my parents become homeowners. So we moved when I was younger, maybe in third grade or so. We moved from an apartment in one part of town to my parents bought a house. And that house was $100,000. And it was like, we were like one of the first, and my mom is one of eight. So we were one of the first of the eight to actually have a house that we owned. And it was this big thing. And it was a new development. So I saw houses going up all the time. And thought, oh, this is cool. And I'm good at math and I can draw a little bit. And so I put some of these things together. But as far as my longer journey, it's been a bit circuitous. I went to UVA undergrad for architecture and took professional practice as a pre-professional student, which was really insightful for me because it told me a little bit about how the profession worked and who the players were, who the stakeholders were. And so I decided, if I'm going to do this, I need to be both the developer and the architect. So that's how I ended up at Georgetown studying real estate development. I graduated from UVA and went to Georgetown and enjoyed that, worked in real estate for a little bit, and then thought, wait a minute, I got to get back into architecture because we know architecture is like the real thing, right? If you don't have architecture, then you don't have anything. That has to be center stage. Reached back out to UVA's central office. That's not really the right word, but I reached back out to the university and I knew I wanted to travel. Like I had never been out of the country at that point in time. And so I asked if we had any alums in France. And they said, yeah, here's a short list. They maybe gave me a list of 10 or 15.
I didn't realize that was a thing you could do. Just ask.
Well, it was one of those things like, if I want to go somewhere, but I need someone to kind of, you know, so I did that. And I cold called them, which is like kind of funny because people don't do that anymore. But I called them and I called them one by one and said like, hey, you know, I'm trying to come, you know, I see you're an alum and can you host me for maybe a summer or a year or something like that?
Bold. Kendall, that is so bold. I love it.
I got a bite. Actually, I might have gotten one or two, but there was one person, Jacqueline Delano, that was willing to bring me on. And I moved to Paris for a little under a year and worked for an architect there. And that's where I decided I did not actually want to be a licensed architect. Which we can go into, you know, at some point, but it helped me realize where my gifts lied.
Yeah.
Like where my innate gifts were. And I think I could have, if I had actually done more practice in the States, could have been a whole completely different trajectory. So I came back to the States and decided my gifts are working with people. I love education. If I could be in school, I'm in school right now, right? But if I could be in school forever, I would. Like I would just, if they would just pay me to learn everything, I would do that. So I started teaching K-12 architecture. I taught some summer enrichment at a community college for grades 3-5. And then I taught grades 6-12 architecture and did that for 6 years or so. And while I was doing that, got my doctorate in education from Regent, which is in Virginia Beach, a small private, super conservative, but they have really great pedagogy. So don't align with the school's political stance, but
right.
They create great teachers. That's mm-hmm. one of the things they do for the state of Virginia. And so I got my doctorate in education there, researching architectural values. And then, long story short, this is the short version, believe it or not,
right.
you know, ended up at the Association for Collegiate Schools of Architecture, ACSA, as the director of research and information.
My mind is very much blown right now, because I knew some of this, but not all of it, particularly not the talking to UVA alums to move to France for a year to work at another firm. That's amazing. So were you working, like, do you know French? Or did they speak English? What was the language barrier like, or was there
one? Je parle un petit peu de français. Like, I speak a little bit of French.
Okay.
But I think that in the grand scheme of things, I'll tell you, I mean, I, like I said, at that time had never been to France. Mm-hmm. And I got there and I was alone, which somehow I still felt pretty safe, but I was there by myself and I knew a little bit.
Okay.
But I think one of the discrepancies for me, it would have been a little bit better to have been guided, because I was there and for the first, I'd say 3 weeks, I kept looking around like, why are there no African-American people? Like,
gotcha.
I was looking around like, where are the African-American people?
Like, were there like Black French people, just not African-Americans?
But that's what I'm saying. It took me 3 weeks to realize I'm not in America. Why am I expecting to see African-American
right,
people?
Right, exactly.
Right. So there was a little bit of like, not necessarily a place where I felt like I fit, but okay. it was a great learning opportunity. It propelled my French language skills, which I don't necessarily have anymore, but it was just a great experience to actually consider what it meant to be global. Like we talk about globalism, but
yeah, that's super fascinating. And so then when you started teaching architecture K-12 and getting into like the collegiate teaching, what are some of the architectural skills or topics that get covered with kids that aren't in college?
Yeah, it's really interesting. For the youngest children, I usually just focus on what it means to create space, like that we are in space all the time, usually grounded by our feet. But what does it mean to create space? What does it mean to imagine new spaces? Like, and you know, they make houses usually that are like pink and green, and that's okay because we're creating space, you know? And you know, it's interesting. It wasn't until you asked that question that I'm recognizing how my research presently around authorship and the experience of people on the street mm-hmm. understanding architecture is actually quite related to that, right?
Like, yeah.
So for the younger kids is that. For the older students, like grade 6 through 12, it's thinking about architecture as a technology, something that we continue to create, thinking about what informs the spaces we create and what are the societal conditions. For high schoolers, like I can take them through an exercise that talks about what we learn from trees as monuments, which can be like really abstract. But I can also, like, we would do proposals in the school parking lot. So I have them out there measuring the school parking lot and bringing it back and trying to guesstimate the topography, right? You know, I also taught engineering just as a technical education teacher. And I used to joke that my architecture students got a really good architecture teacher, and my engineering students maybe didn't get the best one. So,
right. Yeah. That's fascinating. And so then you said your current research, you're studying how, I guess, people on the street are interacting with architecture, perceiving it. Say more about that.
Yeah, I came back to Harvard DSD, Graduate School of Design, to explore the intersection of race, architecture, and education. And I feel like personally and professionally, we are doing the discipline a grave disservice by not educating students. And this is like all students, right? It's not just Black students that
exactly.
need to know.
Everybody
about.
Needs to know.
Yeah, yes. Like, but not educating students about how history and systemic barriers inform the spaces we create.
Absolutely.
And so I'm currently in the process of trying to develop a new theory that is about a socio-political process around how we create space. Like, instead of actually being hyper-focused on the product and form and formalism, what if we were hyper-focused on people? What if we didn't look at models from a sky view? I mean, we're so focused on the exterior. What if we thought about really what it meant to be in the middle of the space, ascending the fire stair? Like, what does right. that mean for somebody, right?
Right. Yeah, that definitely changes the perspective and the feeling of it. Because you're right, architects do typically tend to think about what does it look like on the exterior. And yeah, there's the interior spaces and the flow and all that. But for the most part, the renderings, the sexiness, the images and the money shot, all that is the exterior far away, how it fits into the context. And so there right. is that, how does it fit into the existing context? But that's a very different question than how does it feel to be moving through that space?
Right. And so one of the things, you know, growing up in Virginia and almost any part of the state, you're surrounded or in some way in relationship to the plantations that are, you know, might be 10 miles, might be 60 miles, but the plantations that are there. And so it was kind of born out of that. Like I started to look at plantations, the way that they are structured around power and wealth, and actually situate Black people in that space. Like they belong in that space. They just belong in a specific part of that space. And so I took that and pared it down to, if you look at, you know, what history is, I think equally as important, if not more important to you than it is to me. But if you look at the forms and shapes and ornaments of housing in the 1920s through the 40s, especially brick houses, they're very much so many plantations. Like they very much so appropriate the slate roofs and they appropriate other pieces. And so in a city like Petersburg, Virginia, which is, you know, where we used to live, we still live in central Virginia. In a city like Petersburg, which is predominantly a Black city, you still have a white section of the city that is the beautiful tree-lined street boulevard lined with these many plantations mm-hmm. where people are honestly surveilling people from inside. So what does it mean right. to actually be in your city, which is a Black city, and walk in the street and knowing that people are looking at you? Like that dynamic is just...
Right. Yeah, that yeah. constant surveillance is, yeah, that's interesting. The things that I always found fascinating, particularly when I was studying covenants for a National Register multiple property document that I was working on with a colleague, for that document, I got to be a little bit of a jock and just be like, oh, I get to talk about the buildings. Whereas she was focusing more so on like the narrative and all the research and all things. Anyways, I always found it surprising because the covenants, it wasn't that like Black people weren't allowed to be in a space. They weren't allowed to own a space or be in a position of power. Like they were expected to be there in a subservient space, expecting to be the cooks, the nannies, the caregivers, but they weren't expected or allowed to be equal or ownership or anything like that. And so I always found that fascinating, that the mental gymnastics of systemic racism and the systems that we currently have would be such that, no, you can be here, just not in a certain way.
It's exactly representative of that plantation dynamic, right?
Right.
The house, the first house that I ever purchased was in Petersburg. Mm-hmm. And it was a house that, in its deed, one of the covenants was that no one with, I think the covenant actually said 1/5 of African ancestry or blood could own that property. And the house was built in 1927. And so I took myself as the owner as like, ha ha, look at this.
Exactly.
Like, you know, like, but it's definitely something that's born out of history. And so that's what a lot of the work that I do across the country, giving lectures and doing, you know, talking and trying to write about architectural education, is acknowledging that there's a history there that we can't actually start at the time that you enter the site, right?
Right.
Like we got to go way back. And I think it's a challenge for faculty for a number of reasons. I think one is faculty are more likely to teach the way they were taught. That's the skills that they got, whether they went to what is considered an elite school, or they went to a really technical school, or they went to an avant-garde school. That's the training they got. And so they're able to push that training onto their pupils, so to speak. But oftentimes it's filled with architectural theory in history, mm-hmm. but not necessarily the history of people and peoples
right.
that are potentially Black, Indigenous, Latine, you know, right. Asian, or Pacific
right. Islander. Yeah, and it's one of those things where even at UVA and a lot of the other, most of my architecture education, I learned nothing about any of the architects of any color, really. And it was almost kind of like, oh, they didn't exist. It's like, they existed. They were doing great work. It's just they weren't canon because the people who were deciding what was canon and what was important didn't value the contributions of Paul Revere Williams or Norma Scholarek or any of the other like trailblazers on just the Black side. And I know there's a number of Asian American, Native American, there's a number of people of color who've been doing amazing things in the field of architecture globally that we just didn't learn about because it wasn't considered canon. Granted, our EBA education was very European centric and, you know, all that, but still, like there are massive cities in Asia, China, India that were created by amazing, talented people of color that just I don't know about.
I'm right there with you. I think what's interesting is if you talk to people from various architectural backgrounds and different regions, you'll see that people value the architecture that belonged to their ancestors. I did a series in 2020 and 2021 called Where Are My People, where it went through the five major racial groups. And people value, like, as a Black American, I value the work of Julian Abel, right? And I value the work of others that were here and persevering well before my time. And when I talked to the group of Hispanic or Latinx architects, they valued the work of rich cultures and like the Mayan civilizations, right? Like, and so we saw that pop up every time, really, is that people look at their own history because we, I think, have a different understanding of collective.
Yeah, that makes sense. I recently got fascinated when my colleagues turned me on to this book called The Four Cities, or something along the lines of basically it's like exploring four lost cultures, the planning, the amazing design, the amazing lives that were lived, and like really the palimpsest of history that's existed as people just kept living and things kept changing, technology changed, they left. They're just, the world is so much bigger and time is so much longer than what we were taught in architecture school. And so learning more about prehistoric civilizations and even Çatalhöyük in Turkey and just all the different places, my mind was blown. And so just knowing that the world and design and life and space creation is so much bigger than the European-centric architecture that we learned at UVA is something that I'm still learning and I'm still fascinated by.
Yeah, I remember, you know, and I'm not a major history buff. I think I'm actually learning much more history these days. But I remember when Amber Wiley got, you know, one of the first traveling fellowships at the SAH and was able to spend a year just travel. And I was like, this is amazing, you know, because she got firsthand experience of architecture that just wasn't centered in the University of Virginia.
Exactly. And I had her on the podcast as one of the early episodes, and she was talking about her time in Vietnam and how there was like a museum in Vietnam about the war. And they're like, she's like walking in and seeing photos of African-American soldiers on the walls in Vietnam about the war and kind of that, how that changed her a little bit. And it was like, this is fascinating. What are some of the things that you hope for the future of architecture education?
I really hope that we can, it's interesting. I really hope that we can be on one accord that we have to fit in the understanding of social conditions. You know, my area of expertise is specifically race. And I think that's really important if you're studying architecture here in the United States, because even, you know, growing up in the South, I was always under the impression that the most horrific and heinous and most racially charged things happened in the American South, which I still think is true. But, you know, Newport, Rhode Island was one of the largest slave ports. And so I don't know that it matters so much where you practice or where you grew up or where you live or where you study, but really understanding that the context there. And I think personally, this is my own opinion, I think it's okay for schools to have different foci, right? Like, so if I'm studying in South Dakota, then I would expect to have more of an understanding of history from a Native or Indigenous understanding.
Absolutely.
Maybe than the Black understanding. And that will shift, you know, if I'm studying in El Paso, Texas, then I would expect to have more of an understanding of Mexico in relation to the United States. I know we have to prioritize people before products and before place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm optimistic that we'll be able to have more of these conversations where it is just stating what is. I'm thinking more so of some of my white colleagues that I'm working with or some of my white friends, because I'm typically the Black person. How do I say this? I have a lot of friends of a lot of different races. And I'm typically the person who's very fine talking about race and acknowledging what is in a way that doesn't make someone feel guilty or shame or anything like that. Because I don't think that either guilt or shame are productive emotions. So I'd much rather have a conversation about this is why things are the way they are. This is how we got here. Because if we don't understand that, then we can't figure out how we're going to move forward and creating something that's more equitable and just for everyone. And so I really love that idea of different regions actually speaking their truth for what happened, for how they got to where they are. Even the idea of Americans in Texas trying to ignore the history between the United States and Mexico and how Texas came to be, or California came to be for that matter, seems asinine to me. Like, it seems very schizophrenic. If we could just be honest about where we are, we would be able to get so much farther.
Well, I think there are two reasons why talking about race is difficult. Most of the time my lectures are about race and architecture. But I think one reason that it's difficult for people is because a lot of people feel as if you say something negative about the country's history, then you can't still love it, right? Like, how can you acknowledge that there were these immense physical, mental, and emotional harms that were attributed to specifically Black and Indigenous populations, and then still say, like, I love it? But what a lot of people don't understand, which I think projects like the 1619 Project do really well, is this understanding that we were born on the water, right? Like, that as African-American people, at least, that our ties to Africa are distant because that was stripped. So we actually, in many ways, we don't have any other choice but to love America, because these are the cities we built. Like, this is the craftsmanship of our ancestors, right? Even when we walk onto a plantation. The other thing that I think makes it hard, or maybe not so much makes it hard, but is really ironic, is that there's this call not to talk about race, right? Like, it makes people uncomfortable. But if you look at our history, America's history in particular, that's all people did, is talk about race. Like, everything was about race. I mean, who has land? Who can have land? What land they were going to take next? It was all about race. So how do we go from everything being about race in the 18th and 19th century to now, do not talk about race. I think it's puzzling, to say the least.
Yeah, agreed. And like, there's this, for me, because I'm also from Virginia, and even so growing up in a Southern area, and I do, even though it's Northern Virginia, I still consider it South. But it was very much this idea of, it's impolite to talk about race, particularly in mixed company. And so that's something that I've always found puzzling, particularly as someone who's always been more comfortable in mixed settings. I've always been but even at UVA, it was culture shock for me, because my high school was very diverse. I had friends from all different nationalities. I didn't think that Black people were still treated differently coming out of my high school. And then I got to UVA and I was like, oh, this is still a thing. Black people are definitely still treated differently. Oh, wow. But it's like, I got there and I was too Black for the white folks and too white for the Black folks because of the way I spoke. I had friends, Black friends who I'm very close to now, telling me, oh, you're really cultured, you know? So it's like, as a way of trying to say, why do you talk like that? So it was culture shock and very fascinating. So anyways, like the politeness, and I'm like, I want to talk to my friends about things that I care about. And race is one of those things, because it affects everything that I do in my life.
Let me tell you, I was woefully naive. I got to the university, and I think you had just graduated and I was getting there, but I got to the university, and at summer orientation, which they do all the architecture students together, I met two people, two very nice, wonderful white people, Grace and Jasper, and we said, we should get our parents together for the next day. Mm-hmm. And so our parents got together and they had coffee and we just kind of, you know, chatted and so excited. And so we get in the car and my mother says to me, she said, hey, Kendall, I really enjoyed Grace and Jasper, but did you meet any Black people there? Because, you know, she knew what I needed before I knew that I needed it fully. And I said, I did meet some, but I just say hello to everybody. Like, I just talk to everybody. So Grace and Jasper are the ones that I, you know. She's like, okay, well, just make sure, because that's going to be important. I'm like, well, we're past that, you know, like young and naive, which still happens today, even though I think the generation, you know, the Gen Zers have more access to differences and disparities. I think that still happens today. And so I very much so got the same thing. I remember being in I'll tell one more short story. I remember being in studio. I think in that specific studio, I was the only Black individual, only Black person. And I got a call from my grandma. And so I took the phone call, and when I got on, my grandma, I said, "Hey, Grant, how you doing?" And we were just talking, shooting the breeze, and talking just in a very colloquial way, because that's how I talked to my grandma. Mm-hmm. And I stopped. I hung up the phone, and everybody was looking at me, right? And I was like, "What? Why is everyone staring?" And a good friend of mine, a white woman, good friend of mine that was right beside me, she was like, "We didn't know you could talk like that. Like, we didn't know."
Oh, wow.
Like they were listening, but didn't realize like
that code switch.
That my Black, they weren't fully understanding the code switch. And so they were like, "Wow, okay, you're really like talking like a Black person to your Black grandma." Yes, I am.
Right.
I do this for you all.
Like, right. Really? Exactly. Wow. Yeah. Back to that idea of like, how can you love something when there were problems with it or it was problematic or things like that? And I feel like that's just something that, particularly as Black Americans, that we've always done that. I feel like I've always accepted the country for what it is and my place in it, but recognizing that it could be better. And also realizing that it doesn't have to be this hard, especially after it's like having friends of different races, of different income levels, of different socioeconomics, and recognizing, oh, well, that's how they're able to move through the space. So if they're able to move from the space that way, why can't others? And like, it doesn't have to be this hard. These are arbitrary, dumb, artificial things that are trying to keep different people separate. I often think about the fact of how much further along we would be as a society, particularly in the US, if there weren't are these arbitrary rules on who's allowed to do what, who's allowed to have access to funds and education and space, and like how much farther along we would be if there just was less inequality.
Now let's take a quick break to share more about our sponsors. Systems and standard operating procedures. You already know that's how to build a profitable business and how to find the freedom you want. You need systems and procedures. But you struggle with choosing which systems you need most and how to implement those systems quickly so you can get back to doing what you love most. The Designing Your Business Masterclass series was created by acclaimed architect and business consultant Douglas Teeger, FAIA, to help fellow architects and engineers run their firms more profitably while maintaining a healthy work-life balance. Douglas grew from solo practitioner to become managing partner of his 30-plus person firm, and then later sold his firm so he can do what he does today, helping architects be more successful at Teeger Consulting. On the third Wednesday of every month, Douglas dives deep into an essential topic that will strengthen the profitability of your firm and make it sustainable for growth in years to come. You can register now for the next Designing Your Business Masterclass with Douglas Teeger at bqe.com/masterclass and start implementing powerful systems for the profitability you need and the freedom you want. Every live masterclass session includes AIA continuing education credit, and when you visit bqe.com/masterclass, you'll have access to the full library of past sessions on demand. The Designing Your Business Masterclass is free, and it's brought to you by our friends at BQE, the makers of BQE Core, the software that makes it easy to manage your projects and people for maximum productivity and ultimate profitability. Register now for the next Designing Your Business Masterclass at bqe.com/masterclass. That's bqe.com/masterclass. And now let's get back to the show.
And I just feel like there's so many decision makers in the past who have just shot us in the foot or shot themselves in the foot. We could be so much further along if they just weren't racist and were making better decisions.
Right. I 100% agree. One of the things I often think about, specifically when I think about race dynamics or racism in the 18th and 19th century, is I think about the potential loss. Like I think about someone, let's say a Black woman working the cotton fields or the tobacco fields in Virginia, who actually had gifts to be an opera singer.
Like, yes,
but never actually got to realize any of that because of the systems that we had in place. And so, well, I know it's an extraordinary shame. I mean, it's really disgraceful.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed.
But I do think keeping the honesty is important. And I think, you know, if we look at the state of Virginia, for instance, and the major pushback to critical race theory, it's one of those things that is so contrived that it's not even really, I don't know. I'm going to stop there because that'll take us down the rabbit hole. But
I feel you, because the same way that the whole contrived thing of critical race theory being a problem when it's really a non-issue for the majority of the population, particularly if they're not in law school, it's also just, I feel that same way when people talk about cancel culture or being politically correct, because it's like, well, why wouldn't you say things in a way that's not going to purposely offend or disenfranchise people? And it's, I feel like the comments that people want to make, oh, but they can't because it's so politically correct and they're worried about getting canceled, they're trash comments anyway. It's just now they're being held accountable for it. And so I feel like there's a big difference between being held accountable or there being consequences for what you say versus people being too sensitive or those kinds of things. And so I feel like the line between, oh, people being against critical race theory and people thinking things are too politically correct or cancel culture is a problem. For me, it's the same picture. It's two sides of the same. It's the same thing. It's all noise and distraction when we could actually be having honest conversations about why things are the way they are.
Right. No, I 100% agree.
Yeah. We're getting to the end here. And so I would love for you, if you're willing, to talk a little bit about compassion and parenting and adoption and all the good things of the things that make you happy on your personal side.
Yeah, no, thank you for asking. I think one thing that is missing, and I'm going to say across the discipline of architecture, that might not be 100% true, but I think one thing that's missing maybe across our current society is empathy. And empathy is a skill. Like, it's not something, something that you have to work on. My wife tells me all the time that I need to be more empathetic. It's not because I'm not trying, but it's a muscle that you have to actually work to understand. Like, I'm hearing you voice a frustration. I'm hearing you are hurt, or I'm hearing that you're upset or sad, that you experienced something even. And instead of actually giving you a solution, which is typically my thing, it's like, pausing long enough to say, you know what, I understand that. Like, I'm sorry that happened to you.
Yes.
You know, like
acknowledging actually, the human, the emotion of that. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
I would say that we, as our family, we do a lot of things and we try to do things in love, compassion, and grace. And I think grace is a big part. Like, I think people kind of oftentimes understand love, but I think the grace piece is one that requires a shift in thought, because it says essentially that I don't actually need you to be perfect. I don't actually need you to be fulfilling me 100% of the time, that it's okay to make mistakes and it's okay. And I'm going to accept you for who you are. And so I say all that to say, I think the way in which we've built our family, for those who don't know, I'm married and I have a wonderful, amazing, phenomenal wife who is like, if somebody wants to know my secret sauce, it is my wife. It is my wife. She's just the most supportive and empathetic. She's got me beat in that dynamic. Who is white and actually came from a really wealthy background. And so we have a lot of conversations. We have constant conversations in our household about race and socioeconomics and society at large. But we also have two kids that came to us through foster care that we adopted. And they require so much of us because we didn't have them from birth. And I think that has been one of the most humbling things. And it makes parenting a challenge a lot of the times, because I'll never forget, our daughter came to us when she was 10 years old.
Okay.
And when children are in foster care, there are a lot of boxes to check to make sure that you're giving your children or the children at the time the best care, and that you are getting their eyes checked and you're making sure physicals are done exactly 1 year after
Hospital
was done. And so I took her to the optometrist. There we go. Yep. I took her to the optometrist and the doctor was asking questions like, okay, and have you ever had glasses before? And I was like, no, she's never had. And she was like, yeah, I did used to have glasses in kindergarten. And I'm like, what?
Right.
And so one of the things that I think sometimes makes someone a confident parent is like knowing their child. I know my child better than anybody else. And when they come to you through foster care and they come to you with a level of brokenness because the experience is so hard, you can't actually rely on like, I know this child better than anybody. And there's a lot of growth that we see mm-hmm. in our children, the two that came through foster care. And I think that's probably the most humbling part, to be able to show them something different, to see their minds move and trace, and then to hold them when things get hard and are broken. One of the things, and we're very clear, our youngest, when he came to us, he was still one. And we're very clear with him about adoption and coming through foster care. Mm-hmm. But we recognize that sometimes both of our kids, who are now 5 and 14, both of our oldest kids, sometimes they really just need a hug. Like, and it sometimes like comes to me after the fact. I think it comes to my wife a little faster, but I'm like,
right,
you know what? He actually is just really upset and needs a hug.
Yeah. I mean, listen, physical touch is my love language. Sometimes you just need a hug. Like, yeah. I totally get that.
It's not mine. So I have to like actually think, oh, you know what? He just needs a hug to calm down. And then we have another little one that is a year and a half, a little bit over a year and a half, that my wife birthed naturally. And now we actually have one more on the way. So,
oh my gosh, congrats, but four yeah, babies. Okay.
Yeah. That's a lot. It's
gonna be busy
in the city, I will
yes.
say.
You know. Yes.
But yeah, I think we definitely consider it a blessing. And I would say foster care and adoption has been a ministry in and of itself, because like I said, it's definitely not for the faint of heart. It's very difficult. It's very difficult, but that's why it's humbling, because it requires you to give more than you ever anticipated giving.
And I remember, because I guess the last time we saw each other in the pre-COVID times, I want to say it was like at an AA convention. It was yeah. a while ago. But I remember, I think you were going through that process, and I remember just being in awe of all of the things that I knew you were going to have to go through. Because I have a couple other friends who've adopted, and even through foster care, and just knowing that it's a process and it's not a quick process and it's not an easy or, yeah. So I was super excited for you. And I'm glad to hear that it worked out and the kids aren't in the system anymore. And that's fantastic.
Yeah. No, yeah. I'm really grateful for that. And we often say, you know, I often think, I wish we had our kids from birth. But I also know that wasn't actually supposed to be part of their story. Like, they have the story that they're supposed to have.
Yeah.
But I just wish I was able to see our oldest in particular. Like, I wish I was able to hold her in my arms and do some of those things that we didn't have the opportunity to do. And so I think there's a lot of development and relationship building and understanding and, mm-hmm. like I said, grappling with the hard things, because there's loss on either side of,
sure.
of that equation.
Yeah, for sure. You talking about empathy and giving people that pause and acknowledging just the emotions that they're feeling is making me think a lot of Brené Brown. And one of the, yes. you know, she's an amazing shame researcher, and her line of the story I'm telling myself has been a game changer for me and my husband in our marriage, in terms of like, whenever I'm really frustrated or angry because I'm assuming something that isn't necessarily the case, being able to just pause and be like, well, listen, the story I'm telling myself is that you did this because of X, Y, and Z, and like opens up that conversation. And so being able to pause and give them space to feel whatever they're feeling, have the conversation without the assumptions or the perceived negative feelings is super valuable, I think.
Yeah, I think that's great. I love Brené Brown's work because mm-hmm. she does usually make it like really clear and easy to
yeah.
to use. I think one thing I have constantly been going back to is this idea of rest. So I'm in this predicament currently that I feel really grateful for, to be at Harvard University, to be at the Graduate School of Design, to have four other healthy members of my family, to have, you know, we could talk about all these other things that, you know, I've been able to do or able to see. And I think in architecture specifically, there's this culture of production that in many yes. ways mimics this idea of labor that we see across history, right? Like mm-hmm. Chinese labor, we can think about Black labor, we can think about indigenous labor. But I think sometimes for me, it's hard to suss out, I don't know exactly how to say it. It's not necessarily perfectionism. It's more of like this idea that I must be constantly producing to have enough to stand on.
Yes.
If called into question.
Yes, I feel that. You have to be continually productive to prove your worth in case someone tries to call you. Yeah, absolutely.
And absolutely. You have to know, I've been thinking a lot about the architectural canon and the ways in which if I am an aspiring architectural theorist, I actually have to know that European canon just as well, if not better than other people, to be able to substantiate something else. And so I say all that to say, a feed I follow on Instagram is called Black Liturgies. And I screen captured this quote back in November, I believe, that says this. I want to read it because this is, I constantly go back to it. It says, rest will always feel like a risk to those who don't understand the violence of exhaustion. Rest is healing. Stop abandoning yourself.
Ooh.
And I just feel like I have to, like, if you read that, you can't help but force yourself to rest because you're like, this exhaustion can be violent.
Yes. Right? Like, wow. I'm
acknowledging that if I, in this current time, that I am working 20 hours as the research director, that I'm in school full time, that I have a wife and 3 and a half kids that need my attention, that like, that there's actually is a lot going on. And it's okay to feel tired. And it's okay to say, you know what? When I first got here last semester, I had on average 800 pages of reading each week.
Mm.
And so it would be okay. You know, there were times where I would call my wife and say, I really wanted to finish all my reading and I'm 100 pages short. But I really, like, I came here because I wanted to grab the content. And she's like, and that's okay. Like,
yeah.
And I'm like, is it though? And she's like, yes, it is. And so I think there really is something to this idea that like your rest is equally as important as your ability to learn or your ability to produce or your ability to do all those other things.
I love that.
A big thank you to BQE, the makers of BQE Core, for their support of this podcast episode. Visit bqe.com/masterclass to register for the next Designing Your Business Masterclass. This week's episode was produced by Fernando Queiroz. Thank you so much for listening. Links to amazing resources can be found in the episode's show notes. Special thanks to Sarah Gilberg for allowing me to use snippets of her song Fireflies from her debut album, Other People's Secrets, which, by the way, is available wherever music is sold. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the show. And now that Tangible Remnants is part of the Gable Media Network, you can listen and subscribe to all network partner content at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. Until next time, remember that historic preservation is a present conversation with our past about our future. We don't inherit the earth from our parents, but we borrow it from our children. So let's make sure we're telling our inclusive history.
I saw the first fireflies of summer, and right then I thought of you. Oh, I could see us catching them and setting them free. Honey, that's what you do. That's what you do to me.
Calling all AEC professionals. Get ready for unparalleled professional insights with detailed and original podcasts by RCAT. This is the podcast that brings you the untold stories and lessons learned behind the design and delivery of a building project. Hey, it's Charisse Lakeside, aka the CSI Kraken, and your host. Join me as we dive deep into the tales of conflict, triumph, and sheer ingenuity.
Yeah, so when Serena was named for the, it was going to be named for the building, you know, we really were able to work with teams at Nike Branding and how to really infuse her influence and identity in the very public spaces.
Detailed features architects, engineers, builders, and manufacturers who spill the beans on the most complex, interesting, and downright odd building conditions they've encountered.
Another challenge of the shuttle is actually in putting it in launch position is how you brace that seismically. It's really supported by only two pins at the base of the booster rockets. And there's a large base isolator that's underneath the shuttle that kind of prevents it from moving too much in an earthquake.
When you have 600 people or 300 people in a room, acoustically, you really need a high floor to floor so that you can have the right acoustic environment for people to be able to talk, and that speech intelligibility is really good.
Every episode unveils lessons learned and connects you to the products you need to navigate similar challenges. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Detailed today and be prepared for the unexpected on your next project. Every building has a story, and we are here to tell it.